We are not going to finish Philippians 4 today. We are going to still be in that chapter, but when we come back, after me being gone for 3 weeks, we'll finish it up at that point. So, unfortunately, we will have to take a little bit of a break before the conclusion here. So, the next 3 weeks after this, we have, I'm not sure even in what order yet, but Matthew Phillips and Colin Jordan will be in here teaching you guys. And then we will have a couple of home groups in May. Those will be the last two home groups of the year. So after May, we will be no longer meeting at night, Sunday night. And the only reason we're doing two and not three is because of Mother's Day. So May 13th, we will not be meeting at night. So our home groups will be May 6th, the night, and then May 20th, I believe. So they'll be our last two. And what we're going to do for those two Sunday nights, we're going to do a study that I borrowed from a friend over in Jupiter on Proverbs. And Ben is actually going to teach on May 6th, because I won't be here that Sunday night. He'll teach 25 characteristics of a fool from the book of Proverbs. And I'll come back 2 weeks later and teach 25 characteristics of the wise from the book of Proverbs. So I didn't want to squeeze in our book study on Trusting God by Jerry Bridges, because we only have 2 weeks. I didn't want to do that. So that Proverbs study is perfect for a two-week topical series on fools and wise people from the book of Proverbs. So that's where we're heading. After we finish Philippians 4, when I get back, we will probably in June be getting into our friendship series here in the morning. So I think that'll certainly hold your attention. It'll be a topical series on relationships and friendships, a lot of things that you guys are thinking through right now. So that's where we're heading. For today, open up your Bibles, if you have them, to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians 4. And we have certainly turned the corner toward the conclusion of this letter. We could even say that today is the beginning of the conclusion of this letter. Philippians chapter 4. And we'll be in verses 10 to 17 this morning, looking at the topic of contentment. I'll just begin by highlighting a story. A few years ago, there was an article published on DesiringGod.com detailing the relationship and marriage of two individuals named Ian and Larissa, both of them Christians, who began their relationship in 2005 in a pretty typical way for young people. They met in college, started dating, and within a few months of their relationship, had even planned to get married when they both finished school. Larissa, reflecting back on that time, remembers the feeling of falling in love and Ian's sense of humor. He always made her laugh. She remembers a time in their relationship mixed with joy and deep Christian faith. 10 months into their relationship, this is now September 2006, Ian was driving to work to pick up an extra job in order to earn money for an engagement ring, when he lost control of his car, veered into oncoming traffic, and was involved in a very serious accident. He spent months in a coma with a traumatic brain injury, and when he finally woke up, Larissa was confronted with the reality that their lives would never be the same. Ian had permanent brain damage. He couldn't speak, eat, or walk. After the accident, Larissa moved in with Ian's family and learned how to become his caretaker. And she admits, as you could imagine, this was not easy, this transition. She says, "One of the hardest things during that time would be to see couples walking together and holding hands. I'll look at that and think, I'll never do that." She continues, "There's intense grief and intense pain. I would have moments of struggling with God. Why us? Are we being punished for something?" Well, as the months went on, Ian began to show some minimal progress, communicating verbally and getting around with the use of a motorized wheelchair. But even with these minimal improvements, he would still be severely disabled. 4 years after the accident, he and Larissa decided to get married, which on the one hand is a remarkable demonstration of covenant-keeping love, and on the other hand is a reminder of the great difficulties that lie ahead for both Larissa and Ian. Larissa writes this, "We're not sure what our life would look like if Ian could walk or drive himself to work or put his socks on. Sometimes I let myself imagine what it would be like to see a couple on the sidewalk holding hands and wonder what that would feel like. Or what it would be like to come home and see Ian doing simple things like sitting at the computer, checking his email and ESPN. He can't. She continues, getting through a day with a brain injury is hard. If Ian wants to move from the couch to the wingback chair, I have to move him. If he wants a drink, I have to hand him the cup and take it back from him after he swallows. If he wants something to eat, I have to plan out whether or not it'll make him choke and then deliver the bad news if he shouldn't have it. Or when I'm woken up by the sound of Ian throwing up at 4 a.m., he can't move his body fast enough to not choke, and so my body and mind must jolt from my dreams and spend the next hour cleaning up a man who's too tired and sick to hold his own head up. And then we'll end with this quote. One time we were riding in our car, a quick 2-hour trip to my sister's house. I, in particular, this is Larissa, was struggling with a lot that morning. A fairly common struggle for me. I asked Ian if he is often tempted to curse God, a question that may have put me dangerously close to Job's wife. Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die, Job's wife said to him. Ian answered easily, no, because God has been nothing but good to me. And we're going to come back to that story at the end today, but for now, just focus on those words of Ian, a man who in his early 20s or late teens, right around 19 or 20, had his entire normal life taken from him and can answer easily and quickly without hesitation, God has been nothing but good to me. Today we're talking about the topic of contentment. And we'll see that contentment really begins with that mindset. No matter what my circumstances look like, God has done me no wrong. In fact, he has been nothing but good to me. There aren't many people in the world, or the church for that matter, like Ian and Larissa. And that's because there aren't very many people who are content. J.C. Ryle is accurate when he said, probably one of his most famous quotes, two things are said to be very rare sights in this world. One is a young man that is humble. The other is an old man that is content. Contentment is arguably the most elusive trait to mankind. Now, what is contentment? Well, there's a few ways we can describe it. In the New Testament, the word for content or contentment, in a just strict literal sense, means self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency. Now, not the type of self-sufficiency that's wrong or sinful in the way that we would use self-sufficiency in the church. It's rather self-sufficiency in the sense of being sufficient or satisfied independent from external factors, like your circumstances. I'm not dependent on circumstances to be satisfied, and in that sense, I'm self-sufficient. That's how it's used. That's the word content in the New Testament. Now, we can supplement that with a few practical definitions of contentment or discontentment to help us think about what this issue is. If anxiety is expressed commonly in the what-ifs of our mind, discontentment is expressed commonly in the if-onlys of our mind. Negatively, we could say it this way, to borrow the words of one pastor, contentment is the death of self-entitlement. To be content is to let go of the sense of personal entitlement as it relates to your needs and your wants. To be discontent is to have some level of unrest that drives you to imagine you deserve something better. So contentment is the freedom from wanting more, the freedom from wanting better, the satisfaction, the peace, the rest with what we have, who we are, and where we're going. Contentment is resting peacefully in the sovereign purposes of God, understanding that God brings both pleasure and pain according to his good purposes. And I really like Sinclair Ferguson's definition. True contentment means embracing the Lord's will in every aspect of his providence simply because it is his providence. It means we're able to say, along with David in Psalm 23:1, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I shall be content, is what he's saying. Whether it's beside the peaceful still waters or the tumultuous dark valley of that psalm. So how do we get there? How do we possess this elusive and rare godly characteristic that is expected of all who follow Christ and yet possessed by so few? How do we get to a point where we can experience massive human tragedy and learn to wholeheartedly acknowledge that God has been nothing but good to me, resting peacefully and content in His sovereign care? Paul's going to give it to us this morning. Four principles of contentment in this passage. Four principles of contentment. Notice the first principle in verse 10. Providence must be joyfully accepted. Providence must be joyfully accepted. You want to be content? It begins with a joyful trust in the Lord's providence. Notice verse 10. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you've revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Now, you remember all the way back to our introduction, we are coming now full circle to one of the main reasons Paul wrote this letter. Namely, to acknowledge and express his gratitude to the Philippians for their financial gift to him to care for his needs. Remember, chapter 2, 25 to 30, this gift was sent to Paul. Remember who carried the gift to him? Epaphroditus. Right, he went to prison, he went to Rome, and Epaphroditus almost died getting this gift to him. He risked his life for his sacrificial service. And with this being one of the major themes of this letter, it might seem strange to us that Paul hasn't discussed the gift in detail until now. In other words, a position of a thank you all the way at the end of the letter almost sounds like it's an afterthought. Oh, by the way, thanks for the gift. Like a perfunctory expression of gratitude. But this is really just completing the thought that Paul began this letter with. Take a look back at chapter 1, verse 3. He didn't get into the specifics here, but he began the letter by thanking them for their partnership, their fellowship in gospel ministry. Notice verse 3. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always offering prayer with joy in my every prayer for you all, in view of your participation in the gospel from the first day until now. Notice verse 6. For I'm confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you, that's the good work, the sacrificial giving, will perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus. For it's only right for me to feel this way about you all, because I have you in my heart, since both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you are all partakers of grace with me. You have partnered alongside me. You've experienced the grace of sacrificially giving the gospel ministry. Look back to chapter 4. He didn't wait to thank them until now. He began the letter by thanking them with general terms, and now he concludes it with a specific acknowledgement of their gift. And as he gives these details, he's providing us with the principles of contentment. Now, where are we getting that language from? Providence joyfully accepted. Well, notice here in verse 10 that Paul is rejoicing, so there's the joy, in the Lord. So, I'm rejoicing in the Lord for something that the Philippian church did. So, right there. It's not the emphasis of the passage, but it's worth noting. To be content, you've got to embrace the sovereignty of God over the actions of other people. I rejoice in the Lord because you did this. God's sovereign over your actions. Why is that a principle for contentment? Well, because if you believe, let's state it on the negative side, Paul experienced good treatment from them, but let's say that he experienced negative treatment. If you believe that mistreatment of you is meaningless, without purpose, or outside of God's sovereignty, you're going to respond sinfully. You can't be content. So Paul demonstrates the mindset we're to have. He rejoices in the Lord greatly because this church did something. That's a proper view of the providence of God. What did they do? Oh, the text says, you have revived your concern for me. So I rejoice in the Lord because I know your renewed concern for me was in His sovereign plan. And I also know the fact that you couldn't help me until now was also a part of His sovereign plan. Notice the end of verse 10. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. It's not that you didn't want to do it. You had the concern, you had the burden, you just didn't have a chance. You had no ability. In God's providence, even though you were willing to meet my need, you were temporarily unable to meet my need because you lacked opportunity. You simply couldn't fulfill it. Now, let's do a quick refresher on the context here of this letter so we can understand what Paul's referring to here. 10 years. 10 years have passed since Paul initially arrived in Philippi in Acts 16, preaches the gospel, the church starts, the church is formed. It was a healthy relationship. He loved them. They loved him. But even with this healthy relationship and the mutual love, 10 years had passed since they had supported Paul in his missionary endeavors. Why didn't he complain? Why didn't he manipulate them into giving more? Why didn't that produce bitterness in Paul? Why wasn't he uneasy and discontent? Because he knew that behind the actions of people is a sovereign God. So he tells the church, I know it wasn't because you weren't concerned. I know you wanted to help me, but something prevented you from helping me. You lacked opportunity. God's providence. Your circumstances weren't conducive to helping me. The text doesn't say what stood in the way. What? Why were they lacking an opportunity? It doesn't say, but I think we could speculate with an educated guess that it was their poverty. We know this church was not an affluent church. We know they had opponents. They were a persecuted church. So that's a combination that could prevent someone from doing anything other than just surviving as a church. Poverty combined with persecution, you're probably not going to have much outreach in your church. Whatever the reason was, they couldn't support him for these 10 years. But it wasn't part of sin. It wasn't part of a lack of concern. They were unable to do something based on something outside their control. But as soon as they were able, they sent Epaphroditus with a financial gift to Paul, and he says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. Your concern, it's remained below the surface. It's been dormant all these years. It's been there. You've always been concerned, but now it's revived because now you can actually do it. Literally, to bloom again. That's what the word means. You've revived your concern. It's now blooming. It's just lied underneath the ground, but now the circumstances have now rained on it in a favorable manner, and now your concern is blooming. You're able to do it. It's revived. Well, if Paul wasn't joyfully trusting in God's providence, he could have easily responded sinfully to their action. He could have began to think, oh, you guys are living better than I am in prison. Come on, get it together and get me some money. Or don't mind me, I'll just be waiting here in prison, rotting away while you guys decide how much you're going to give. No resentment, no bitterness, no discontentment here on Paul's part. He had entrusted himself to the Lord's providence. When his needs were met, he rejoiced and gave thanks to God. When his needs were temporarily withheld, he knew God was providentially delaying what he needed. So, first base, when it comes to being content, is how you relate to God's providence. What is God's providence? It is God's care for the creation, involving his preserving its existence and meticulously guiding it to his intended ends. In other words, providence is the outworking of God's sovereignty, his sovereign control over your life. Every person who is discontent needs a crash course lesson, first and foremost, on the sovereignty of God and the character of God. If you are discontent in life, there is a major malfunction in what you believe about God. What do I mean by that? Well, by its very nature, discontentment rejects either the sovereignty of God or the character of God or both. It has to. Either God is not in control, or he is in control, but he just isn't wise, good, or loving when it comes to me and my circumstances. You have to believe that to be discontent. So if you believe in a God who isn't sovereign, you can't be content. Why? Because then you have evil, suffering, affliction happening to you with no purpose. It's an accident. Satan's in charge. Man's ultimately in charge. No reason to be content. I can't trust God. Or if you believe in a God who is sovereign, but who isn't wise, isn't loving, isn't good, you can't be content. Because sure, he may be sovereign, but he's evil. Or he's not good, he's not wise. He doesn't know how to bring about the best things in your life. Can't be content in that worldview either. So you've got to recognize that behind your complaining, behind your frustration, behind your discontentment, the uneasiness in your hearts, is a system of lies that you're believing about God. When we can't joyfully accept God's providence in our lives, we are doubting God. Discontentment is unbelief. Paul recognized the reason his needs and wants in life hadn't been met the way he wanted. He recognized that's under the sovereign control of God. An anonymous author writes this, I will not take that, I think I quoted this when we looked at James 1 a couple years ago, but I will not take that bitter thrust which rent my heart today as coming from an earthly source, though it appeared that way. But I will look beyond the tool, because my life is planned, I take the cup my Father gives, I take it from his hand. Now those that watch may wonder why these things do not disturb. I look right past the instrument and see my Lord superb. I look right past the Philippians not supporting me for 10 years and I see it. I see it's God's plan. The trial which would lay me low must pass through his hand. He holds the outstretched cup to me. I take it from his hand. That's first base. First base when it comes to contentment. Paul looked behind the actions of human beings, behind his circumstances, and he saw a sovereign, good, wise, loving God behind everything. Joyfully trusting in God's providence. The second principle of contentment is that you must believe that position in life is irrelevant. So providence joyfully trusted, position in life is irrelevant. In other words, contentment has nothing to do with your circumstances. It is above, it transcends circumstances. Notice verses 11 and 12, or just 11 for now. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. Although Paul appreciated their gift, although it benefited him greatly, he wants to make it clear, I didn't feel neglected. My expression of joy doesn't arise because once I was poor, but now I have money. No, I'm not writing this because I'm someone who has any needs that aren't met. In fact, I don't have any actual needs that haven't been met. I don't speak from want. But we have to notice how he explains this. You would expect verse 11 to read this way. Not that I speak from want, for God has supplied everything I need. That would be true, right? Mm-hmm. You could expect the text to say that. Just when I thought I was going to die from hunger and exposure in prison, God came through and provided for me. But that's not how he explains it. Notice. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I'm in. Paul says, I've learned that if I have something, God has determined that it's good and necessary for me to have it. And if I don't have something, God has determined it's good and necessary that I don't have it. So I can be satisfied independent of my circumstances. No matter what my life looks like, I believe what God says about my circumstances. I don't believe what my flesh says or the world says about my circumstances. And that's why I can confidently say, Paul says, no matter what my life looks like, I don't speak from want. Sure, Paul would acknowledge, maybe my needs aren't met as fully as I want them to be met, or even in the timing or the way I desire. But I have everything I need to do God's will and glorify Him. That's what it means to have your needs met. I have everything I need to do God's will and glorify Him. See, Paul was living out what we see elsewhere in the New Testament. Listen to 1 Timothy 6:8. Think about this, just falling on us as Americans. If we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. It just so simplifies the issue and rebukes the restless heart of so many in the church today. Always grasping and lusting for the next thing, the nicer model, the upgrade, the change in circumstances. You've got to camp out right here, 1 Timothy 6:8. If I have food and clothing, with these I shall be content. The point is, Christians are those who should be content with the basic necessities of life. They're not to long for and be consumed for and be characterized by a lust for more. Or the writer of Hebrews 13:5, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. When we're longing for more, longing for better, longing for this, longing for that, we're implying God's not been faithful. God's withholding something from us. When we recognize what we truly need, we can see that we really don't have any needs that aren't met. Maybe they aren't met as fully as we would like them, or in the timing that we want, but we have everything we need to glorify God and do His will. If you're characterized by discontentment, and thus probably in bondage to your ever-changing circumstances, you have to ask yourself this question. Why is Christ not enough for me? Why is forgiveness, reconciliation, righteousness, heaven not enough? Why do I demand God give me more? And you say, well, all right, well, we're humans, so we're always desiring and wanting things. So how do I know if my longing and wanting is an idolatrous desire, a desire stemming out of discontentment, or just a normal human desire? Well, one easy way is I'll sin if I don't get it, or sin in order to get it. That's how you can identify an idol. How do I know if my desire is just a human desire, just a want? You can be content and have gratitude and rejoice if you don't have it. And you can rejoice when you see others get the very thing that you want. That's how you can know if it's a benign desire in that sense. Paul learned that your position in life, your circumstances, are irrelevant when it comes to contentment. Notice the end of verse 11 now, and 12. For I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. What circumstances? Verse 12. I know how to get along with humble means. That is to say, I know how to be brought low with regard to having very little. I know how to live in a state of poverty. There's one end of the spectrum. And now he goes to the other end. I also know how to live in prosperity. That is to say, I know how to live in a state of abundance when my earthly goods and earthly supplies abound, when I have more than I actually need. Why does he give us two ends of the spectrums of life here? When things are really bad and when things are really good, I know how to be content. Because you're equally vulnerable to discontentment in both situations. Notice what he says. I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am, whether poverty or prosperity. That doesn't make sense with how most people view contentment. If I could just make a little more money, if I could just have a little relief, if this would just change, then I'd be content. That doesn't make any sense with what Paul says. He says, I have to learn to be content when everything's going great and I'm prosperous. See, the lust of the flesh is never satisfied. You ever notice that healthy, rich, prosperous people who have everything in the world, everything in the world could possibly want, they're just as discontent as those living in poverty with the same heart condition? You ever notice that? If prosperity made you happy, then rich people would be happy, but they're often miserable. The nature of lust is that it's never satisfied. You're as vulnerable to discontentment in bad times as you are in good times. It's just a different temptation. When things are good and easy and prosperous, you can find satisfaction in those things. You're tempted to trust in those things, to depend on your material abundance. Notice the middle of verse 12. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. You can see he's not just talking about when you don't have what you need, when things are bad. When I'm full or go hungry, when I have more than enough or suffer need, I've learned the secret of being content in every circumstance of life. That word for I've learned the secret, it's actually a passive verb. What that means is, it literally means this: I've been initiated into the secret or the mystery. I have been initiated. It's something that's been done to me. Paul's using it metaphorically here to speak of being taught through a process. I've been initiated into the mystery, the secret of how to be content above my circumstances, no matter what's going on. He's enrolled in God's school. God has taught me through good times and bad how to cope not only with hunger and need, but with plenty to eat and in abundance. So you want to be content, you have to enroll in God's school of contentment. Notice the language again. Contentment there is learned. I have been initiated. I've learned past tense, completed action with ongoing results. Interesting. Paul doesn't say, I keep on learning. He says, I've learned. I went to school and I passed. I've learned that lesson. Why is that significant? Well, for one, it demonstrates that contentment has nothing to do with personality or natural gifting. Some people were not born more content than others, and that's why some are discontent and others are content. No, that's a smokescreen from a discontent person. Well, you just have a more mild personality. Things don't bother you. You can be satisfied with so little. That's just how you were made. That's how you were born. That's why you don't trust in your abundance when you have it, or flee the Lord when you're in poverty. No, Paul says that person is like that because they've been in God's school. They've learned something. They've allowed God to take them through his school of contentment. How so? They're no longer dependent on circumstances for their contentment. That's what they learn. Contentment transcends position in life. Here's what that means practically. Just a few practical scenarios for you. If you're discontent as a single person, because of your status as a single person, you will be discontent as a married person. I don't know where we got the idea that marriage magically makes your sin and weaknesses go away. It actually does the opposite. Marriage amplifies your sin and weaknesses, and now there's much more on the line because it doesn't just affect you, now it affects another person. So if I'm discontent as a single person because of my singleness, in marriage, I'll be discontent with my spouse, or my house, or my money, or my kids, or whatever it might be. If you're discontent at one job, you're going to be discontent at your next job. Even though you're going to be tempted to think that, I just got to get a new job, and that's going to solve this problem. No, it doesn't solve your problem. You've got to remember, when you're struggling with discontentment in a given circumstance, God is trying to teach you. He's trying to teach you in that moment contentment. He's trying to initiate you into the mystery, the secret that eludes the majority of people. Satisfaction and peace. In other words, contentment. Contentment. Transcending your circumstances. I can't tell you how many times, whether in my own life or hearing it in the testimonies of others, I've seen this very theme. A person is battling to joyfully accept God's providence, battling to cultivate contentment independent of their circumstances. And when they come to a point where they're content, it's then that God changes their circumstances for the better. Because they're no longer idolizing new and better circumstances. In other words, if you're in Christ and you're constantly coveting better circumstances, unwilling to cultivate contentment in the position God has for you right now, you could be prolonging your current circumstances because you're unwilling to enroll in God's school. You don't want to be taught. Maybe the Lord is totally willing to change your circumstances, but he has a lesson to teach you first. And if you won't respond, sometimes, all right, it's going to stay right here. It's going to stay right here until you humble yourself and start to learn. And then oftentimes you'll find that once you are at peace with God's providence and you repent of coveting better circumstances, it's ironically then that sometimes you get relief. Your circumstances change. Not always, sometimes. Let me give you an example of that. I came here almost 2 years ago as what you would call a bivocational pastor. You guys remember that? So that means the majority of my time throughout the week was devoted to the company I worked for, and then whatever was left over, I'd give to the church. But I was full-time still at my company. Not my company. It's more Ben's company than mine, but our company. Now, I went to seminary, so I was used to teaching on a regular basis. I love to do discipleship and counseling. That's what I wanted to spend my time doing, not listening to people complain about their pools. Okay? So it was a challenge for me to devote the majority of my time to something that I really wasn't passionate about. I loved the company, but I really wasn't passionate about it. I didn't want to be doing it. I would always tell my bosses, I love you, but I don't want to work here another day in my life. I love this company. So as my job started to get a little more difficult, more responsibility, the company's growing, so more things getting added on my plate, less time for ministry. What's the temptation there? To start to get discontent. Start to get discontent. To view that season of life as pointless. It's holding me back from ministry. Now, I was not given a guarantee that the church would ever be able to take me on full time, but I was given a realistic timeline of 2 to 3 years when I first moved here. 2 to 3 years, if the church keeps growing at the rate it's growing, we can probably take you on. So here's how I had to battle that temptation to covet different circumstances. I had to believe that God was sovereign and that he was wise, good, and loving for me to be in the exact scenario I was in. I had to believe that this was best for me, my family, this church, and God's glory for me to be in that bivocational role. Had to believe that first and foremost. Second, I had to acknowledge that I will be given that role when I'm ready for it personally, as in my own personal sanctification, when I can handle the temptations and the demands of pastoral ministry. And when my family would be prepared for that role. That's what I had to believe, secondly. Third, when I'm ready for that role pastorally. I had to believe if I'm not full-time, then I need to work on areas pastorally to be ready to shepherd the church. Fourth, when I'm ready theologically, continue to study, get ordained, develop my own convictions in certain areas of doctrine. So, that's how I renewed my mind to think about that issue. I will come on full time when the Lord has determined this church needs me full time. I'm ready personally. I'm ready pastorally. I'm ready theologically. That's how I battled it. Now, can't say it was easy. Didn't come in a day, didn't come in a week, didn't come in a month, but as I spent the first year here, I can truthfully say I got to a point where I was content with my current lot in life. I still strongly desired to come on full time, but I had cultivated contentment. I had gratitude, joyfully accepting God's providence. It wasn't more than a few weeks later that I got a call from Mark saying funds have become available and we can take you on full time now. And that was obviously 2 years, 2 to 3 years earlier than I thought it was going to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that you're able to twist God's arm to change your circumstances. Just work really hard to be content and then I'll get the circumstances I really want. No, that's still idolatry. The Lord would see right through that. It also doesn't mean that contentment guarantees God will change anything about your life. But it does mean that no matter what circumstances you're in, you can be at rest and completely satisfied. You can have the freedom from wanting more because you know God is sovereign over your circumstances. Here are a couple of practical examples of what it would mean to learn contentment. This is how you can know that you've learned it and cultivated it. You look at something or someone else or a position someone else has, and you would really love to be in their shoes. You'd love to have what they have or be who they are or be in their particular position. You really want that, but you have a conviction it's good for them to have it and not good for you to have it. That's how you can know you're content in that moment. It's loving and wise of God to give it to them and loving and wise of God to not give it to you. Or when you ask this question to yourself, why does God bless others and not me in the way I want to be blessed? You recognize it wouldn't be loving of him to give me what he gave that person because I would turn it into an idol, whereas that person wouldn't. That's contentment. Contentment says, if I don't have something, I don't need it. Because I know God's sovereign and he could give it to me if I need it. If I don't have it, that means God's determined I don't need it. And I'm resting in that. Paul learned contentment in any and every circumstance. He learned that one's position in life is irrelevant. Now, what's the secret? I've learned the secret. Well, the third principle of contentment is power divinely given. Power divinely given in verse 13. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So contentment is independent of circumstances and dependent on Christ. Christ empowers you to be content and satisfied independent of your circumstances. And all things here is at the front of the text in the original, so it's being emphasized. All things I'm able to do by the one strengthening me. All things. Now, what's the context here? Well, it's not sports. It's not class. It's not activities that require you to go above and beyond. That's not at all what Paul has in mind. You certainly should depend on God for those things, but that's not the context here. All things is restricted to all kinds of circumstances and life scenarios. In other words, verse 12 is what all things is referring to. How to be brought low, how to live in prosperity, being filled, going hungry, having abundance, suffering need. I can be content in these things by the one who strengthens me. What's he mean here? What's he mean by this power, the one who strengthens me? Well, glance over at 2 Corinthians 12. Okay, 2 Corinthians 12, you have the Paul detailing his very mysterious plight to heaven, and he's hesitant to describe it in detail. In fact, he can't even find human words to describe what he saw, but the Lord knew that this type of spiritual experience could potentially produce pride in the Apostle Paul, and so he allows Satan to bring affliction into Paul's life, either in the form of physical affliction or perhaps a human messenger that was tormenting him and who was demonically influenced. There's debate as to what that is. The text doesn't tell us. But in either case, Paul was brought very low. He was extremely afflicted. And notice what he says, starting in verse 9. And he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power." There it is. God's enabling power is perfected in weakness. "Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ," there it is, "may dwell in me. Therefore, I'm well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. I can do all things through the one who strengthens me." You guys see the parallel idea there? Contentment is learned, back to Philippians 4. Contentment is learned when we come to the end of our own resources, the end of ourselves, and we exhaust all of our mere human wisdom and thinking and strength. And in that desperate moment, that desperate season, we turn to God and experience supernatural strength, which produces contentment. You feel overwhelmed. You feel at the end of yourself. You feel backed into a corner, taken captive by your circumstances, and now you see no way out. You're desperate. Good, because now you're a candidate to go to school and learn the contentment of God. It's learned through affliction. See, verse 13 is not a verse about being empowered to change your circumstances or win the big game. That's not what's being talked about. In other words, we'd be misreading this verse by saying, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me, so I can be wise enough and power enough to change all the things that might go wrong in my life and make them go better." No, this is a verse about relying on Christ in order to be content in the midst of circumstances you can't change. Practically speaking, verse 13 means this: whatever your life currently looks like, with all the difficulties and challenges, it is sufficient to secure your satisfaction and your spirit of submission. Your exact circumstances. It's not about what's going on outside of me, it's about what Christ is doing inside of me. To quote one pastor, that's what contentment is focused on. Not what's going on outside of me, but what Christ is doing inside of me. That's what we see here with Paul. When he was most aware of his own weaknesses and inadequacies, he became most aware of Christ's power resting upon him. This also shows us that we aren't to use our weaknesses, difficult circumstances, as an excuse for disobedience and lack of submission. Because you can see it over and over, 2 Corinthians or Philippians 4, it is in our weak moments and in our weaknesses and in our difficulties that Christ empowers us. So we can't use those things as an excuse to not submit. When I'm weak, it's then I'm strong. So contentment finds power divinely given, or dependency in Christ. Fourth principle of contentment we now come to: preoccupation with others. Preoccupation with others. You want to be content? Stop focusing on yourself. Get lost in the needs of others. This will be verses 14 to 17. Look at who, we could say what, but look at who Paul is focused on. Verse 14: "Nevertheless, you've done well to share with me in my affliction. You yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. Not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit which increases to your account." Now, verse 14 begins with that word "nevertheless," because Paul is again wanting to be careful not to send the wrong message. Remember, this was a poor church, a faithful church who had sacrificially, out of their poverty, raised money to support Paul in prison. And he just got done saying, "I don't speak from want. I've learned to be content in any situation. I don't have any needs that have gone unmet. I can do all things through him who strengthens me." So the church might read that and think, "I guess he didn't need our gift. Paul doesn't really need our partnership in the gospel. Paul's not really thankful for our gift." Maybe they could be tempted to think Paul was saying this: "Who needs people? Who needs a church when I've got God on my side?" So Paul corrects this. "Even though I'm content in whatever season and circumstances God's providence brings into my life, nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction. You've done a good work, a noble work. He's highlighting their sacrificial service as commendable. You entered into my affliction with me, and my burden became your burden. 1 Corinthians 12:26. If one member suffers, all suffer together. That's it. That's the mindset of every person in the body of Christ. Paul's suffering, we're the body of Christ. That means we're suffering with Paul. His burden's our burden. Notice the details here. They were unique in their support of Paul. Verse 15. You yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I left Macedonia, this is 10 years ago, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. So he's looking back and saying, when this church was planted, you were the only church that supported me when I left. Now, it was brief. It didn't last. They became very poor and persecuted, but you're the only church. This church had the least amount of resources, but they were the one who partnered with Paul and supported him. And notice, he refers to their actions as giving and receiving. I think that's referring to verse 17. Not that I seek the gift, so there's the giving, but I seek for the profit which increases to your account. There's the receiving. You gave to me, Philippians, and you received something in your account. You give a tangible physical gift and you receive a spiritual reward. Your spiritual account increases. And that's a participle. I seek the profit that is continually increasing to your account. You invest in the gospel, you're attaining spiritual interest in your heavenly reward column. You've got a heavenly interest rate going on. Jesus said it this way, Matthew 6:19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. How do you store up treasures in heaven? Right here. You don't cling to your earthly resources. You freely and sacrificially give of yourself and your resources to gospel ministry. We're going to look at giving next time we meet, next time I teach. We're going to expand on this a little bit. Paul says, that's what makes me rejoice in your sacrificial giving. That's what I seek for all of you, the profit that continues to increase in your heavenly account. Yes, I appreciate that my needs are met, but my joy is in the spiritual blessing of others. He knows that such an attitude of liberality pays great dividends in the lives of those who give. Turn back over to 2 Corinthians 9. We're just going to see this principle. And again, we're going to tackle this head on next time. But 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 8. We've allowed the prosperity preachers to ruin passages like this in our day. We should never let false teachers ruin the Bible for us because they abuse passages. We just need to look carefully at what's being taught. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 8. Now this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. He who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency, same word as contentment, having all contentment, sufficiency, in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. Now, this isn't talking about the prosperity gospel where you sow $10 and you get back $100. That doesn't make any sense in light of what we've been studying today. I know what it is to live in poverty, Paul says. No, that's idolatry. That's not sacrificial giving. Look at the text again. So that having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every lust, every human desire. No, for every good deed. That's why we say you will be given everything you need to obey God. Every good work, every good deed. So back to Philippians 4:17, Paul's not saying you did well to give me all that you gave me because now I can live how I want to live with the comforts I've come to expect. No, it's not the gift I'm consumed with. It's not my own change in circumstances that I'm consumed with. Rather, it's the profit which increases to your account. This is why he was content. Even when he was in affliction, even when he was in significant difficulty, the preoccupation, the focus of his life was on the spiritual benefit of others. This is something you'll always find lacking in a discontent person, so consumed with getting more for themselves. So consumed with making sure people are reaching out to them and living up to their standards. So consumed with making sure they're comfortable and taken care of. So centered on self that they rarely think of initiating service toward others. Sure, they might sign up for things because they feel compulsion to do when asked about an opportunity. But in terms of initiating, having a mindset that's like, how can I pray for you? How can I meet needs in your life? Having that initiating mindset, that's going to be absent in a discontent person. You can't be content if you're set on consuming others. If other people exist to meet my real or felt needs, either way, I'll be discontent. This theme in Paul's life is remarkable. Over and over, just in the book of Philippians, something hard or difficult is happening to Paul, and he's consumed about how it affects the church. He's concerned about the spiritual well-being of other people. Well, you've got to be preoccupied with others, serving them, thinking about their needs is more significant than your own if you want to be content. So, four principles of contentment by way of review. Providence, joyfully accepted. Position in life is irrelevant. Power, divinely provided. Preoccupation with others. Back to Larissa and Ian, that couple that we introduced our time with today. She writes this: one thread of consistency over the past nearly 6 years since Ian's accident, so this is now 2 years into their marriage. One thread of consistency is the secret that Paul spoke of. For me, watching Ian, contentment has often felt elusive and like it was always two steps ahead, never allowing me to catch up. I think that characterizes so many people right there. They view contentment as two steps ahead, never allowing me to catch up. Oh, if I could just get this, or if I can just change this one circumstance, I'm right there. I just got to turn the corner, and then I'll be content. That describes so many. So she's articulating that. Soon after Ian's accident, I often deceived myself into thinking that situational changes would move me up a few on the contentment scale. But as our situation continued in pain, God was teaching me, little by little, what this secret means. I didn't know contentment in my prosperity. So before the accident, she said, I didn't know what contentment was. Contentment then meant health and ease, not God. God has not given us an indication that Ian will be fully healed here, which means that we have needed to enlist ourselves in our suffering. There it is. We're going into the school of God's suffering. We are learning that contentment is produced as we obey and act on his promises, like the one mentioned above, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So, a remarkable couple. You guys can go on, it's actually John Piper's website, and you can, it's like a little 8-minute video of their lives, and get the tissue box out. It's not going to be, I'd be surprised if the majority of you make it through, but such an incredible, incredible story. So Ian and Larissa, they have their own website too. But a very, very good testimony of learning contentment and covenant-keeping love in marriage as well, those two principles. So before we pray, any